You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Patricia Williams.
Let me shift gears and go back to Littleton. I want to go back and make a second observation about the dynamic there. I want to draw your attention to the strikingly consistent protestations of the residents of Littleton, Colorado, in the immediate wake of that shooting. It couldn't happen here. We're not that kind of people. So repeatedly, so unselfconsciously, this is not the Bronx. This is not the inner city. Now, the national conversation about what went wrong pinned down the coordinates of our monstrous affliction of violence, bombs on the internet, violent videos, single mothers, authoritarian fathers, guns, and amazingly enough, not enough guns. But if the denizens of the inner city, in particular young black men like Amadou Diallo, Patrick Dorismond, and a now heavenly host of others, have been made so fearsomely suspect that their reaching for their wallet can provoke a panic of preventive killing, privileged young whites often seem to stumble through life as the victims of what I'll call innocence profiling. Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris seem to have been so shrouded in presumptions of innocence that after professing their love for Hitler, declaring their hatred for blacks, Asians, and Latinos, on a public website, no less, downloading instructions for making bombs, accumulating the ingredients, assembling them under the protectively indifferent gaze, or perhaps with the assistance of parents and neighbors, stockpiling guns and ammunition, procuring hand grenades and flak jackets, threatening the lives of classmates, killing 13 and themselves, wounding numerous others, and destroying their school building. Still, the community couldn't seem to believe it really happened there. Still, teachers and classmates all continued to protest that they were good kids, solid citizens. Even their probation officers, assigned after Klebold and Harris were caught burgling a car, had released them to their parents while praising them as intelligent young men with lots of promise. And I wonder, what is this force, this devotion to Blindman's Bluff, to mystery and disbelief? There was quite an astonishing little item in the paper recently about the sort of thing that makes me glad I grew up in the inner city. That is the national proliferation of so-called assassination games among mostly white, suburban, middle-class, and upper-class youth. High school students across the country, even in the wake of Littleton, organize mock war games as a rite of passage or of spring. AP assassination is what one school in exclusive Westport, Connecticut, calls the hunting season that begins right after advanced placement testing. And for approximately 3 weeks, students track one another around the school, around the town, with toy guns. And at one school, 5 actual car crashes were attributed to the chase. And the student left standing after this grueling process of elimination wins, rather than getting expelled as in Decatur on the spot. One exuberant 18-year-old who aspires to be a physics professor dismissed criticism as politically correct overreaction and likened the game to playing cowboys and Indians. No Indians were apparently available for comment. Now, in contrast, the most recent shooting in New York occurred as follows. It got seriously confusing in New York when 5 black kids apparently held toy guns to the heads of 2 undercover officers who were flashing gold chains and cell phones. The kids pointed what looked like real but were actual toy guns at the police officers' heads. And I have no doubt that they intended to rob them. Nevertheless, the level of nuance of difference between this and what happens in Westport, Connecticut strikes me as being a difficult one to sort out. In any event, in Brooklyn, the real police officers the other day produced their own very real weapons and fired 23 rounds, leaving 2 of the robbers dead. Meanwhile, over at PS 103, the week before, a police officer ran through a busy schoolyard at recess, brandishing a loaded gun, chasing a purported drug dealer. Several children were injured in the chaos that ensued as the kids fled in terror. By all accounts, it has become very difficult in New York City to tell who is a police officer and who is a madman. Nevertheless, reading about all of this, in contrast to what goes on in Connecticut, it began to dawn on me why perhaps all those kids in Colorado could go on and on about how, quote, normal Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were. I began to appreciate why the authorities might find it hard to pick out any further suspects from a student body whose poetic sensibility is suffused with the metaphors of bloodlust. Although, again, I wonder if assassination games were played in the inner city, if they wouldn't end up with exactly the same outcome as occurred in Brooklyn. Again, I'm not trying to excuse anything that happens in Brooklyn, but I keep thinking of the 3,000 police that were sent to surround the few hundred people who showed up for the admittedly vile Mr. Khalid Mohammed's much less than a million youth march in Harlem a couple of years ago. And again, I want to contrast that with what happened in Colorado, where only 300 police were called out for when the entire school was bombed with grenades. Now again, I don't want to excuse Khalid Mohammed's craziness. I don't want to excuse brawling in Decatur. But I do want to make a call for a sense of proportion and for the necessity for parity. On the one hand, I think about Dylan Klebold tootling around Littleton in his BMW with its trunk full of bombs. And I can't help thinking about the black dentist in New Jersey who was stopped by the highway patrol more than 100 times in 4 years before he finally traded in his BMW for something more drably utilitarian. I don't know. Perhaps the power of what we call the normative to induce moral blind spots can be appreciated for its depth and complexity only when the world, for some reason, gets turned completely upside down, as things seem to be in New York City at the present time. Perhaps, after all, it is not accidental that nationwide so many of these school shootings seem to occur in communities whose populations, quote, fled to the suburbs to, quote, escape, and whose residents have been socialized to think of themselves in such automatic opposition to inner cities and hyperbolically imagined bad neighborhoods. Perhaps it is not surprising that the disgruntled children of such invested fears would choose to act out their community's worst fantasies by this sad, sad minstrelsy in overdrive, these sad white children rendering incarnate the ultimate black-masked, black-cloaked, super predators whose guns are bigger than yours. As William Blake described such a psychic state, the bat that flits at close of eve has left the brain that won't believe. The owl that calls upon the night speaks the unbeliever's fright. Thank you.
Thank you. That was excellent. I'm wondering if, in your experience, or in if you, in your observations, have found that there's more racial profiling. Obviously, there seems to be more from whites towards blacks, Latinos. Seems like everyone else. But is there, what's going on in between other groups, and is there just as much profiling going on in other directions?
I don't think that there's as much profiling in other directions when it comes to the category that is of most concern, which is criminal profiling. But it is true that there is profiling of all groups. I was speaking in Ohio recently, and apparently the police in the airports there have a nun profile, because nuns are assumed to be bringing in undocumented persons, apparently. So somebody looks nunnish, they are apparently more likely to be stopped or questioned. There is a wonderful book by David Cold. I believe it's called No Equal Justice, if I'm not mistaken, in which he describes the kinds of profiling that occurs at airports. And he took a series of cases that went to trial, or that came into the courts at any rate, and made up a list of all the characteristics of given by police for stopping people, and it included they were walking too fast, they were walking too slowly, they seemed to be suspiciously casual, they seemed to be very uptight, their hair was too short, their hair was too long, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, no, if there's a human shape to it, it can be profiled. And part of the problem with the whole question of profiling is when it has a lack of relation to anything remotely related to probable cause for having committed a crime. And again, race is not such a factor. Race by itself is not such a factor. Class by itself is not such a factor. Walking too fast, walking too slowly is not by itself such a factor.
You were talking about police state. You made a reference to the police state. And it feels like increasingly there's more and more and more surveillance in this country of lots of people. And, you know, it's particularly targeted at different groups with racial profiling. But the surveillance in general, the increasing surveillance and ability to have surveillance of everybody in all sorts of contexts seems to be just an incredibly big thing that not a lot of people are talking about. There's a lot of denial around that, and it feels like we're just becoming more and more increasingly a country where this kind of surveillance just, we can be followed at all times, at all moments, but there isn't much of a reaction to that.
Yeah, I do think it's a surprisingly lukewarm. I think there actually is a lot of discussion in certain spheres. For example, when the chickens come home to roost, there is a tremendous amount of outrage in black communities about this kind of surveillance. I don't think that it really has been publicized. You see some of it. But I think if you actually go to certain black communities like Brooklyn and Harlem, you can feel the tension. 90% of the protests, the street protests, haven't been publicized. There is enormous unhappiness in these communities about what's going on. South Central Los Angeles, the same story. Various communities around the country. I think there is tremendous concern, but the larger media, for whatever reasons, isn't picking up on it. I do think that there is a complacency in the police sphere, as it's characterized about policing, because, again, there's this racial divide. There have also been lots of articles in the New York Times about how Giuliani still has lots of support among white constituents, because they really do feel that it is better for them to have this kind of policing in black communities. But again, my fear is that this won't stay in black communities. This is not going to be an issue just for black communities.
Right, and it's almost like that sense of people being able to deny it because white people, because it's in the black community.
But
then until it touches, you know, other groups.
And it's beginning to in New York. That's why I find New York sort of interesting. You find, you know, it's started to reach Giuliani's policies with regard to all kinds of groups, whether it's jaywalkers or street vendors or taxi drivers, is beginning to really bother people, or is beginning to be understood as part of this surveillance, you know, walk a straight line or you'll be arrested. Now, I also think there has been tremendous concern in other areas of surveillance or profiling. For example, in credit cards, online, there's been some concern in New York City because there is a camera on every corner, in the parks, every place, some concern about that. But people, by and large, again, have rationalized that they feel safer. But again, this information is not just used for crime. And online, people are being tracked very, very effectively, financial data, shopping patterns, and so forth. And again, while some of this is makes all of our lives easier, some of it will come to haunt us.
This weekend, a friend of mine came up from New York City. He's a young 21-year-old American male. We've been friends for about 4 years. And we have lots of ethnicity and race-oriented conversations. And he's fairly outraged by some of the things that are going on in New York. So he was telling about the latest, the Dorisman, I believe, the latest thing that had gone on. I guess since his visit, there's probably more in the last 2 days. And we talked a lot about that. Later on, we moved on to a discussion about prisons. This is later on in the weekend. We started discussing prison populations. And he had a very particular view about that, in that he was very supportive of prisons and very supportive of the death penalty. And so I just decided not to go there with him. It was Sunday, and and I was tired. So, you know, we didn't talk too much about that, but the prison industry has been on my mind for quite a bit, especially marking the milestone of a million black men 18 to 25 in prison. I think it's a milestone of 1 million black men 18 to 25 in prison. And so I wonder what you might offer, if you have any thoughts about the correlation between this idea of racial profiling and a police state and this prison industry that just seems to keep rolling and rolling and rolling along.
I have many, many things to say about this. I don't know where shall I begin. I won't go into all of them right now. I mean, I am heartsick. I don't know how to address the sweep of your question, but I am obviously a very, very strong opponent of the death penalty. I am a great fan of Barry Scheck and the Innocence Project. We should impress upon ourselves that his DNA project has shown that 1 in 7 people on death row are innocent thus far, that of the tests that have been done. again, this is an astonishing statistic for people who were condemned to die. Now, again, in terms of who is in prison, again, every statistic shows that young black men and women, to a lesser extent, but young black children or people, young blacks, are arrested at a greater rate, are convicted at a greater rate, serve longer sentences, even where the crimes are virtually identical. Again, one of the reasons I like Sheikh et al.'s most recent book is that it talks a little bit about the issue of credibility, the malleability of credibility, not just according to race, but generally, the identification of witnesses and how unreliable that can be. And I think we really, really need to take stock in a country that has allowed much of the actual evidence, not just in the courtrooms, but the actual statistics of who commits which crime, to be so completely trumped by fictionalized accounts and, again, hyperbolic imaginings of the ubiquitous black criminal as being responsible for everything that's wrong in this society. The concern I have as well about the criminalization process is something that I was perhaps making a subtle allusion to earlier when I was talking about the article in the New York Times about the NYU undergraduates who were using names and so forth about their addictions to speed and borrowing or taking, stealing, whatever, other people's prescriptions, compared to young blacks who might do the same thing, who would be subject to imprisonment without a thought. Again, there's been much publicity, perhaps, on about the Rockefeller laws in both California and New York, but a movement now spreading to other states. So the judge has very little discretion, even for violators who are completely nonviolent. And again, the distinction between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, crack cocaine being generally taken by black youths and having much, much higher, you know, 15 to 25 years for possession, as opposed to powder cocaine, 5 years or whatever, which is a drug mostly consumed by young whites. This is not to excuse the drug industry, but I am somebody who generally looks at the 1 million and the rising numbers, and so many of them, the vast majority of those being drug offenders. And I'm tempted to reiterate the position of one of my law school classmates, Kurt Schmuck, the former mayor of Baltimore, who said, this is a matter for the Surgeon General, not the Attorney General. And we can seem to realize that when it's NYU co-eds. We can't seem to realize it when it's young black kids in Harlem.
My question is somewhat related to the prison industry. Recently, those of us who applied for financial aid from the federal government were asked a question whether we had ever been convicted of a drug-related crime. And it seems to me that there's a direct correlation in terms of who is being convicted of those crimes and that they're not going to have access to federal funding. I was wondering if you had any comments on that, and particularly any strategies to address it.
I'm not familiar with this particular form. I mean, I am concerned that the increased criminalization of people who are a population, whatever population that may be, which is increasingly depressed, and it seems to be that our entire United States population, half of them are on prescription drugs and the other half are on illegal drugs, you know, Prozac and crack cocaine. But I mean, we are a society in some trouble. So as long as the state continues, the criminalization, the increasing criminalization, I mean, they're going to run out of crack addicts and move on to Prozac at some point. This is a real problem. Now, there's a second problem, which is that people convicted of crimes lose, in certain states, the ability to vote, not just loans, but, you know, lose a whole range of ability to participate in society. That's of great concern. Of tremendous concern that populations should be so substantially disenfranchised. And again, these numbers represent substantial disenfranchisement, particularly in communities that are already underrepresented and whose social concerns have been unmet in the past and seem destined for yet even further underrepresentation. So I worry about disenfranchisement at every level with the collection of this kind of data and with the enforcement of these kinds of consequences. Does that answer your question? Is that the...
Yeah, I guess we're just trying to figure out what to do about it. I mean, because there's going to be a whole... Yeah. We're just wondering who's going to drop out of school because they can't get financial aid next year. And Yeah. You know, it's not something everyone's going to stand up and say, by the way, this is why I'm dropping out. It's going to be a silent elimination, I guess.
Yeah. It's not going to be easy. This is not a popular time to argue for the decriminalization of drug use. But again, I think that that's partly why I try to bring into some sense of parity what goes on in terms of drug consumption in white middle-class and upper-class populations with what goes on in largely minority poorer populations, that there is a parallel to ours as a society which is self-medicating itself tremendously, which I take as a sign of depression, mass depression, not necessarily criminal behavior, and that we should really take a look at it in those terms.
I was recently in London, and I was in Hyde Park, and I was in Speaker's Corner, and there were about 5 African-American men, and they were saying how one of them was at a lecture, and after there was a Q&A session after the lecture, a professor asked, well, if I were you, I'd want to kill all white people, knowing what you know. And the black man responded saying, well, that's how you think, and me as a black man, I don't think that way. And I was wondering on your thoughts of how the majority of white people have created this stereotype of how they think that black people would want to kill each white person if they gained control and became a majority.
Yeah, I think Thomas Jefferson said that was his great fear, and this has been handed down from word of mouth and spread like doctrine ever since. I mean, the fear of 3 or more of us being a riot has been, the perpetual fear of the slave revolt, of the ex-slave revolt, of the inner-city revolt, of whatever, of the necessity for 3,000 police to quell the Million Youth March. I mean, it's just one example, it seems to me, of that fear. There are certainly angry young black people, angry old black people who would like to throttle the next white person they see. I don't mean to discount that, but I do think that you're quite right. This is a highly exaggerated fear, which becomes, again, like the walking gets defense of rational racial fear that every black person is waiting to kill a white person, and therefore, you know, you have to keep them out of the neighborhood, you have to keep them confined. That it becomes its own sort of rationalization. Again, let me make it sort of parallel. If one wants to persist in that fear, let us also include in that fear the far greater numbers of organized young white people who profess on the internet and elsewhere that they want to kill black people because they're so angry. But again, the level of organization and the amount of resources on the other side of this question should give us all a great deal of fear. Again, I think that we are an extremely violent society, and I don't separate those instances where you can show me somebody who says, I hate white people, from the same person who also says, I hate women, I hate gays, you know, I want to beat my child. That we are a society in an epidemic of violence. I think our racial history has been a great source of it. We've permitted a great deal of extra-legal and legalized violence from which we're still recovering. And again, the possession of guns has exacerbated this, but the degree to which it's become stereotyped and overstated is its own source of danger.
I think all this sounds terrific, but what can I do on a grassroots level? You know, write a letter once a month to Congress? What are things that we can do? What are the best organizations to contact to make change?
I am always hesitant to give blanket prescriptions. I mean, I can give you my favorite list of organizations, from mentoring organizations, teaching, you know, kids, to advocacy organizations as a lawyer that I support, from the NAACP to Now Legal Defense and Education Fund to some of the more traditional ones. Yes, writing letters is great. But I also think that at least part of this is really a matter of commitment to applying it day to day in conversations. Of the harder work is not writing the letters. The harder work, it seems to me, is when somebody makes a racist comment, to really come back and argue that to the ground. When you find yourself with children in a school that is all one race, to really demand that the institution change. when the neighborhood is all white, to really ask how that can be changed, what's going on. It seems to me that those are also a really important part of the political work that has to be done, of the commitment to make the civil rights movement a reality. Schools and housing and employment, it seems to me, are areas that are being increasingly privatized and therefore depoliticized, taken out of the purview of the civil rights movement in these times. And thus, it does become much more important that individual citizens, particularly white citizens, join with blacks in this quest for integration, that we not give it up. And that really means going to where you are located and insisting that change starts there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals, programming from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The Institute invites your comments on the series, Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy, via their website at www.radcliffe.edu/feminisms. The producer for this series is Laura Ross-Kos, director of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. Thank you for joining us.